Thanks very much, Jane. It's great to see you all here today. Today we're going to spend some time looking at this psalm and assessing our lives. Now, the other day I was looking at a website, a business coaching website, and it encourages people to make an assessment of their lives, and it claims to show people the way to stop having problems, to enjoy personal growth, business success, and happiness. Now, Psalm 90 does something similar to that. Verse 12 is the key message of the psalm, so have a quick look at that. It's on page 596 if you've closed the Bible. The psalmist prays, "So teach us to number our days, that we may get a heart of wisdom." Now, this business website encourages people to transform their lives. It does so by encouraging you to assess those little areas of life that where you don't do things as well as you should. And it says those little details of life are the root of all your problems. And it says if you assess them and respond by following the targets on this website, you'll be right on the way to an attractive and vibrant future. They've got 100 simple targets to meet. Here's a few just to give you an idea. Get the right amount of sleep. Surround yourselves with beautiful things. Make sure your clothes are well ironed. Have hair just the way you like it. Always tell the truth. Put people first and results second. And my favorite, rarely use caffeine. Use caffeine less than 3 times a week total. Well, the psalmist also wants us to assess our life. Again, in verse 12, he prays that God would teach us to number our days and therefore we'd get a heart of wisdom. But he comes to a totally different conclusion to that website. That's because he looks at God's world, God's way. Now, verse 12 is a turning point of the psalm. So the two sets of verses either side of verse 12 show us what it actually means to number our days and get that heart of wisdom. In the first 11 verses, he shows us how someone with God's wisdom will assess life. And then afterwards, in verses 13 to 17, he shows us how someone with God's wisdom will respond to life. In verses 1 to 11, he shows us how not to be deluded, but to see God's world, God's way. So that brings us to the first point on the handout. Wise up to God's reality. The psalmist does this by getting us to look at God. Have a look at verse 1. Lord, you have been our dwelling place in all generations. Well, there's nothing remarkable about that. He starts with God. But when we stop to assess our lives, how often do we start with God? Don't we, when we assess our lives, we think about our history, where we've come from, our environment. We think about comparing ourselves to people around us. Or we might be like that website. We assess our performance in the detail of life. But instead, we should look at God. We should assess ourselves in relation to God, because God is home. He is our dwelling place. As Mark mentioned, it's summer holidays time, and some of you probably feel like you're the only one left in the office. But if you do get to go on holiday, then perhaps you'll get to stand on top of a mountain. And when you do that, you experience a big perspective change, don't you? You look out on the scenery, and suddenly you feel insignificant and temporary. Thinking about God should have a similar effect, but much bigger. Have a look at verse 2. Before the mountains were brought forth, or ever you had formed the earth and the world, from everlasting to everlasting, you are God. See, the mountains look as though they've been there for millennia, but God is before them all. Now, I don't know about you, but don't we often think that we are the stars, and God is just a cameo character somewhere in the background? But God is the lead character. He is the eternal ruler. If we rewind time, God is there. If we fast forward time, God is there. In fact, God is outside of time and space. Let's stop and assess our life and get the right perspective. Start by thinking about God. See, we're not doing God a favor when we pay him some attention. We are just short-term tenants of God's. We're just passing through. Can we see that? Can we see that God is eternal and we're mortal? The psalmist underlines that God is eternal and we are mortal in verse 3. He does that by reminding us of Genesis chapter 3 and the origin of death. He says there, "You return man to dust and say, 'Return, O children of man.'" Adam and Eve wanted God's throne, so they reached out and they took the fruit. And all of us have done the same. We have tried to be like God. So God returns us to dust. Do you believe that? Do you believe that death is a judgment from God? Sometimes the media gives us the impression that perhaps we can cheat death. The newspaper supplements are always full of information about superfoods and health kicks. Now, I love raw broccoli and blueberries as much as anyone, but no matter what they say, our lifestyles, our health fads, our gym membership won't make any significant difference. Instead of being immortal, we today are experiencing God's judgment and curse. As that clock ticks, we are all slowly dying. It might look as though some are dying faster than others, but we're all dying, returning to dust. Are you preparing yourselves and those around you for your death? We often persist in delusions of grandeur. We forget that and we think we're the important ones. We're significant. Have you heard the story of the ant and the elephant crossing a rickety bridge? After they've crossed, the ant looks up to the elephant and says, "Boy, didn't we make that bridge shake?" Often our perspective is a bit like the ant's. In our minds, we overplay our own importance relative to God's. The psalmist corrects that in verse 4. 1,000 years in your sight are but as yesterday when it is past. 1,000 years of human history, they're just really insignificant compared to God. But yet, humanity persists in its rebellion against God. Do you ever find yourself thinking, "I don't want to thank God or acknowledge him. I want to do what I like." God is, he's just impotent. He's just an old man in the sky. He's irrelevant, out of date, out of touch. He won't do anything about it. If you're tempted to think like that, square up to verse 5. "You sweep them away as with a flood." Now, the floods in recent weeks in Tewkesbury should act as a small reminder. The same God who swept away the people in Noah's day will one day sweep away our houses, our careers, our savings, our insurance policies, all those things that we think make us self-reliant. Our dreams of security, self-sufficiency and success are just that. They're dreams. We need to pray that God would teach us to number our days. Now, I've been to a lot of weddings in my life. I've been asked a few times to be the best man, to be an usher, to take part in the service. How many times do you think those couples have asked me to be a godparent? Absolutely none. I just don't get it. But if I were ever to receive that honor, what does this psalmist teach me that I should pray for that child? Surely he teaches me not that I shouldn't prioritize praying for that child to have a great school, have a great job, and a great marriage. The first and foremost thing that I should be praying is that God would teach him to number his days, see things God's way, and wise up to the fact that God is eternal and he is mortal. Verse 5 rams this home. "We are all like a dream, like grass that's in the Middle East, that's renewed in the morning, and in the morning it flourishes and is renewed, but in the evening it fades and it withers." We all need to wise up to reality. God is eternal and we are mortal. In verse 7 to 8, the psalmist moves us on to explain why it is that our lives are so short. And that takes us to the next subpoint on the sheet. God is angry because we're sinful. Verse 7, "For we are brought to an end by your anger. By your wrath we are dismayed." God is furious and his fury is devastating. It is the biggest problem facing us. It's not the problem of our finances, our relationships, our careers, or even our health. It's not those lifestyle issues that were listed on that website. It's the problem of Genesis 3. It is God's anger with our sin. If you have godchildren or children, will you pray that they'd number their days? Will you pray that they'd see God's world, God's way, that they'd wise up to the problem that Almighty God is angry with them? That's their biggest problem. But why? Why is God angry? Have a look at verse 8. Quite simply, he can see us. You have set our iniquities before you, our secret sins in the light of your presence. However much we'd like to, we cannot hide from God. Like an enormous spotlight, God exposes our rebellion, our thoughts on the tube, our conversations in the office, our actions in the home. And so God is angry, and his judgment on our lives is awful. It's really awful if only we'd see it. Look at verse 9 to 10. For all our days pass away under your wrath. We bring our years to an end like a sigh. The years of our life are 70, or even by reason of strength 80. Yet their span is but toil and trouble. They are soon gone and we fly away. Let's number our days. Let's think about it. We sit here in the middle of one of the most sophisticated cities in the whole world. Our psalmist couldn't have dreamt about the gyms, the health spas, the nutritious foods, the medical technologies that surround us. And praise God for all of them. Yet what do you think is the life expectancy in the UK? For women, it's 81. For men, it's 76. So the psalmist, 3,500 years ago, is right on the money. Death is not just an inevitable result of the passing of time. It is God's judgment. And no amount of lifestyle changes, healthcare progress, will throw it off our backs. And what about his description of life full of toil and trouble? What do we think about that? Life is often wonderful. But if we see beyond the holidays and the bonuses, stop and consider our experiences, do we see that life is futile? We live lives that are under the cloud of God's anger. It's like imagine you're working in a prestigious city firm, but your career is going nowhere. The boss is against you. Day after day, you go to work, and it's toil and it's trouble. You're working under the cloud of the boss's anger. Year after year, there are no promotions. Your efforts, your suggestions go nowhere. It's debilitating and futile. The pointless career ends with a sigh, sidelined and unfulfilled. Yet God is not a mean boss. Rather, it's like we've accepted the wages and the perks, but we've worked for ourselves, not for the owner of the firm. The owner's intentions for the firm are clear. They're well publicized, yet we've ignored them. So we can't argue that we don't know what he wants, and it's no surprise that our career is under the cloud of the owner's anger. When we get to verse 11 of this psalm, it should shock us and challenge us. Who considers the power of your anger and your wrath according to the fear of you? Nobody seems to consider the power of God's judgment. Do you see it discussed on Newsnight, in the news? All sorts of other problems are discussed, but this is the world's biggest problem. In fact, I heard someone say that 75% of people in this country haven't ever written a will. It's just an indication of how oblivious we are to God's sentence of death. But will we do the mass and get a heart of wisdom? God is eternal and we are mortal. We are sinful and God is angry. Our persistent rebellion against God is laughable. He will sweep us away like a flood with eternal judgment. So that's point one. We need to pray that we'll assess life rightly. We'll see our real problem. We'll number our days, wise up to God's reality. He's eternal, we're mortal. He's angry because we are sinful. So what's the solution? Where do we go from here? And this is the second part of numbering our days and getting a heart of wisdom. And so it's our second point, wise up to God's solution. Now some of us might be saying, it's as though the psalmist can read my mind. The first 11 verses fit exactly with my experience. A lot of us know that life is short and difficult. In December, a friend of mine woke up in the middle of the night with her husband ill. Within a few hours, she'd lost her husband of only 18 months. And many of us know as well the pain involved in this life. And so in one sense, numbering our days isn't that difficult. But we do need to recognize that the pain and the trouble in this life is because we have rebelled, because we are under the clouds of God's anger. If we don't acknowledge that, if we don't acknowledge that sickness, death, and futility in this life are a result of God's anger for our sin, what will we do? We'll try all sorts of pointless, worldly solutions to make our lives better. Now, we may laugh at the advice on that website at the beginning, but don't we often try and focus on those superficial ways to make our lives better instead of turning to God? But the first 11 verses of this psalm show us that our real problem is not our indiscipline, but it is that God is angry and against us, and lifestyle changes won't help with that. There is no solution apart from going to God. So wise up to God's solution. But what is it? What is God's solution? Well, verses 13 and 17 will show us. This is the first talk in our short series in the Psalms. And the book of the Psalm, all of the Psalms put together are arranged into five different books, each with a different emphasis. And for this series, we're in book 4. Now, in the previous book, book 3, there are Psalms there that reflect, they all reflect on the judgment the people of God were experiencing because of their rebellion against God. And they paint a picture very much like that we've seen in the first 11 verses of this psalm. So just turn back a page to the last psalm in book 3, Psalm 89, and verse 46 at the bottom of the page. How long, O Lord, will you hide yourself forever? How long will your wrath burn like fire? Remember how short my time is. For what vanity you have created all the children of man. Then if you flick over and look at verse 49 as well. The psalmist cries, Lord, where is your steadfast love of old? See, it's very similar to the first 11 verses of our psalm today. The terror of God's fury and the futility of man. So we come to book 4 looking for hope. And so it's no accident that this book kicks off with a prayer of Moses. See, Moses knew that sin leads to God's anger, but he also knew something else. He knew that there is a solution to God's anger, and he knew it rested with God. And that's what we see in these remaining verses. Now, I don't know how much of the Moses story you know, but God had rescued the people of Israel from slavery to Pharaoh in Egypt. And within weeks, they turned away from God, and instead of worshipping God, they worshipped a golden calf. And God threatened to leave them and destroy them. But Moses stepped in and pleaded for the people. And we're reminded of that incident by verse 13. Return, O Lord, how long? Have pity on your servants. You see, Moses is the ultimate defense lawyer. He is a mediator for the people. He does this because he remembers. He remembers that God is not only a God of wrath, but also in verse 14, he is the God of steadfast love. In verses 15 and 19, can you hear Moses pleading, imploring with God? Don't let it all end here in the desert. We are wicked and deserve death. But let us wake up, knowing you are our God and you love us. Remember the promises you made. Show us your glory. He then prays a wonderful prayer in verse 17. Let the favor of the Lord our God be upon us, and establish the work of our hands upon us. Yes, establish the work of our hands. What do you think? Could the contrast with Psalm 89 be any bigger? Could the contrast with verse 10 in this psalm be bigger? Rather than the debilitating, desperate life of the first half of the psalm, Moses pleads for a complete turnaround. The solution of God's steadfast love means instead of a life that is futile and doomed to failure, Moses can ask for a life with God, a life that is fruitful and is meaningful. So life looks desperate and it looks cursed. But Moses' prayer here in Psalm 90 is there to remind God's people that God's promises still stand. God is a God of steadfast love. There is hope. Do you see that? If today you've started to wake up to the fact that you are mortal, that you are sinful and you live under God's anger, please now see that there is hope. Not only is God the God of anger at sin, he is also the God of steadfast love. Praise God, there is a solution. God is the God of steadfast love. And we see that most clearly on the cross. the divine judgment of God meets the divine love of God. The full effects of God's judgment fall on Jesus Christ, so that God's steadfast love can fall on us. And better than Moses, the New Testament tells us that we have Christ to mediate for us, to plead for us. Jesus can do that because he is perfectly human and perfectly God. While Moses is a mere shadow, Jesus is the fulfillment. He is the perfect mediator between us and God. So despite our rebellion and God's anger, there is a solution. There is a solution to God's anger and life's futility. And it's found in God's steadfast love and Jesus, our mediator. So that means there's no need for us to be crippled by our sin and death. There's no need to fear death and the troubles of this life. There's no need to doubt whether our life can have any meaning. If we are trusting in Jesus, we can rejoice. We can live under God's favor rather than under his wrath. Now, don't mishear the psalmist. The toil and the trouble of this life are still with us. But if Jesus mediates for us, we can pass through this life. Death won't be the end. We will enjoy an eternal home with God, an eternity with God, living under his favor. And here in this life, if we turn to Christ, our mediator, there are amazing benefits. And we see those in verse 17. A relationship with God, the favor of God's love upon us. We can know that we're forgiven. And we can rejoice that because our lives are now fitting in with God's purpose, we've turned to him. We're going in the direction of our Creator. Our work can be for God. We can therefore engage in work that is no longer futile, but is of eternal value. Work that is established. Work that is meaningful. So there's no point in assessing life and then tinkering with the edges of our lifestyle, as that website suggested. If we want real wisdom, we should see the world God's way. We need to see his anger and turn continually to Christ, our mediator, reliant on God's steadfast love. If we have any children or any godchildren, what should we pray for them? We shouldn't just pray that they'd have a great education, a great marriage, a great career. If we want our children to be wise and live fruitful lives under God's favor, don't just pray that they'll understand economics, politics, science, the arts. They'll eat healthy foods and exercise. The number one thing we should pray is that they will do the mass. They will number the days and they will see that God is angry with them. And they will respond by turning to Christ, our mediator. This is a class that none of us will ever graduate from. Our children and us, we need to continually be reminded of this. And that class will lead us to wisdom. Wisdom that leads to eternal and genuinely fulfilling life. We've got a few minutes now to discuss that psalm around our tables. On your tables, there's a sheet with three questions on it. Have a look at those questions together, chat them through, and see how you can encourage each other and discuss that psalm. First one is, what stops us numbering our days and seeing that God is eternal and angry with us? What stops us from seeing life as it's presented in this psalm? And also try and help each other think, how would you persuade a work colleague or maybe a family member from this psalm to number their days? How would you persuade them to have the psalmist view of life and so that they would turn to Christ? And then if you've got time, think about how this psalm has helped you appreciate Jesus more